Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. In their new book, On Courage, How to Be a Dissident in an Age of Fear, political strategist Ami Fields-Meyer and journalist Julia Angwin interviewed over 100 dissidents and activists around the globe, arguing that anyone can defy an authoritarian if they have the conviction to do so. They write, quote, "This book is about what our collective nonviolent power can look like, what it takes to succeed, what gives individuals the courage to fight back, and how you can do it too. People have been fighting for their rights, for their dignity, and for each other for a long time," end quote. On Courage focuses on individual dissidents, dissident communities, the unfortunate side effects of being a dissident, and growing a dissident movement. Joining us to talk about this important book is Ami Fields-Meyer, a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation and a former senior policy advisor at the White House during the Biden administration, where he led U.S. policy initiatives related to civil rights, consumer protection, and technology policy. Ami has served as a strategist to national civil rights organizations, political candidates, and high-profile public officials from Los Angeles City Hall to the West Wing. Ami Fields-Meyer's writing has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy, and other outlets. His new book, co-authored with Julia Angwin, is called On Courage, How to Be a Dissident in an Age of Fear. Hi, Ami. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Well, we are very happy to have you. We started the Authoritarian Playbook series many months ago last year. It's hard to keep up with the time these days. Yes. But we decided to start this series because we felt like many in the media were really not connecting the dots. And I just wonder what your overall thoughts are. Here we are, August of 2026. What are your thoughts about major media coverage of the authoritarian policies we are seeing from the Trump administration?
Well, we decided to write the book for a very similar reason that you decided to start the series. Julia, my co-author, is a longtime journalist. I don't come from journalism. I come from the world of public policy and politics and government. And we felt that in both of our industries, the same thing was happening, that even as the specter of authoritarianism, and I'll say a little bit more about what that means, began to cast a shadow over the country, it felt to me, certainly, like among my really smart, thoughtful peers and colleagues, a lot of people were continuing to treat campaigns as normal campaigns. And certainly, as you describe, it's the media seems to have had trouble really knowing quite what to say, what words to use to describe the really abnormal authoritarian breakthrough. And I guess I would just say, Rose, that part of what I think is happening, why it's hard for Americans of all stripes, not just in media or in politics, to really be able to put their finger on the fact that what they're seeing is authoritarianism, is for two reasons. One, Americans tend to not see ourselves as of the world. We like to be separate and apart. And I think a little bit of that exceptionalism has seeped in. If you look to the statistics about what's going on elsewhere in the world, liberal democracy is now the least common form of government on earth, as I'm sure you've covered. 3 out of 4 people in the world now are living under some form of autocracy. And the United States is really just the latest to slip into this. But the one other reason that I think it's been difficult for folks from media to politics to everyone in between to really identify that what this is authoritarianism, despite people like Tim Snyder and Ann Applebaum and M. Gessen, who are experts in this, telling us that's what it is because authoritarianism looks different than it used to look. It no longer comes into town, at least in this country, on the back of a coup. It's now sort of the slow erosion of our institutions. It looks different. It feels different. We continue to have elections, but the elections can start to be tilted and less free and less fair. We continue to have media, but the media begins to be more corporate, more consolidated in the way that we're seeing. We continue to have courts, but the courts begin to be stacked. And so it continues to look like a democracy, But if you look a little bit more closely, you can begin to see things shifting and changing much more rapidly than we should be comfortable with.
That is a really good point, because if you are out there working, say, two or three jobs to make ends meet, let's say you're a single mom trying to get your kids to school, trying to find housing that you can afford, it is hard to pay attention to all of this. I mean, it's hard enough for us who swim in this every day to keep up. There's so much coming at us on a daily basis. And I wonder what this experience was like for you, given that you studied these issues very deeply, but you also interviewed so many incredible people around the globe. What was it like when you started the project and how you thought about authoritarianism? And then how has that really changed for you now that you've completed this project?
It's a really, really good point about people just trying to make ends meet. And I will say, before I say more about the project itself, I totally agree. And I have found this as we've traveled, we've been to 10 cities to talk about our book, that the abstract concept of democracy means much less to people now than I think it used to. And a lot of that has to do with, what does democracy really mean if I can't afford my rent payment? And, you know, part of the reason that we did the book this way was that I think that if we had just written a book about the sort of the Navalny's of the world or the Mandela's of the world, that would have been an interesting book, maybe a sort of a cinematic book, but I don't really think that it would have been so useful to normal people like me. And what we realized as we began to talk to dissidents, we ultimately spoke to over 100 people on 5 continents, from Venezuela to Hungary to Russia to Hong Kong and beyond, who have stood up to an authoritarian regime in some form or another, have stood up to political repression when there was risk for them involved. Sometimes that risk was really immediate physical danger, but oftentimes the people that we were talking to were people who faced something closer to what most of us will face, which is, I might lose my job, I might lose my reputation, I might lose my community. So I'll say this, when we started interviewing folks, at the beginning of the second Trump administration, we started calling up dissidents from around the world to ask, things are changing in the United States, what would you do? And we started this in January of 2025. Those first couple weeks of calling people from Venezuela and from Nicaragua and elsewhere, really the response from many of these dissidents was, that's cute. You know, two Americans who have finally, you know, who are finding our struggles to be sort of interesting and charming, and I'll humor you for just a second. But they really did not feel like what we were looking at bore any resemblance to what they had gone through. By the end of March, and just to orient people, because as you say, it's been such a deluge, this is end of March 2025. This is, you know, Mahmoud Khalil has been arrested. Rumeysa Öztürk has been arrested. We've begun to see many of these ICE raids. We've begun to see a lot of these attacks on the institutions. Those conversations changed in tone and in tenor. Instead of the sort of skepticism that we were hearing, we started to get responses that were basically like, let me give you advice, and I hope you're writing this down quickly because you're going to need it. And so that was quite humbling. Everything about that experience was quite humbling. But what we found as we spoke over and over again, you know, the fundamental question we started with was, how do people stay safe as they try to defy authoritarianism? I think we thought that we were going to get answers that were very technical in nature. What apps do you use? How do you sort of stay out of the crosshairs of the surveillance state? And we did get some of that. We did write some of that. But so much more of the answers that we received and the stories that we tell were spiritual, or about how people find safety in community and how people band together to get through moments like this.
It's really interesting to hear what you say about democracy, because a number of articles and studies have come out looking at how Kamala Harris spent a lot of time talking about threats to democracy when she ran for president. And it just didn't land with a lot of people, especially those who are struggling to make ends meet. I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts about what happened with her campaign, given that you worked in the White House under the Biden administration. But I wonder, are you in touch with any Democrats? What are they thinking about this now? How to talk to people about the real threats that we're facing, while at the same time talking about people and their everyday struggles?
You know, it's been a great, surprising, but really wonderful blessing for me after more than a decade working in policy and democratic politics to step out of it, at least for the moment, to spend time with activists and here in the United States, but also all over the world. It is something that I think maybe should be mandatory for every political operative or policy advisor at some point, which is really to step out of your world, which is not to denigrate the people who are working, who have worked really hard on these important policy issues for a long time. But yeah, I think there's clearly a major divide and a bit of a disconnect between some of the messaging that's happened in past election cycles and what people are seeing and feeling now. You know, it was even interesting, I don't know if you saw this, just even last night, to see that Alex Vindman, who was a hero of the first sort of resistance era of Trump opposition, I say resistance, capital R in major quotes, who helped, you know, who was a witness, I think, in the first impeachment, who was a whistleblower. He was soundly defeated in the Democratic primary in Florida last night by a Democratic socialist. And without getting into those issues, because I think, you know, I think that they're sort of separate and apart, it was really, that was fascinating to me, to see somebody who came to prominence as a quote unquote resistance hero, as a fighter for democracy, to lose a lot of salience in the public view. So some of this absolutely has to do with the fact that I think that people are just concerned with their immediate day-to-day lives, as they should be. But I do think that there are still examples of people who have gotten really good at talking about democracy without talking about it as this conceptual, through this fluffier conceptual way. And, you know, one of the people who I think is really good at this, who's getting more attention this week, is John Ossoff. But even before this week, when he has attracted attention for talking about, in a sort of prickly, provocative way, an aide to President Trump who he seems to have a bit of a strange relationship with, he was really, really focused on corruption. And I don't know who's advising him, and I don't know what exactly Senator Ossoff has studied, but this is a lesson from other countries. One of the last countries that's sort of tracking along the United States' route that has been able to pull itself out of the authoritarian rut, at least temporarily, is Hungary. And in Hungary, what you see, just a few months ago, the massive elections happened, you see something very similar in that country to what's happening in this country. They continue to have an open media, but the media is increasingly, as I said before, aligned explicitly with the regime. Both state and non-state TV. The same thing is true of the courts. The same thing is true of the civil service, just stacked in favor of the Orban regime. And one of the ways that the opposition leader, Peter Mayer, was able to mobilize massive groups of people was not to talk about quote-unquote democracy. And it also, Rose, wasn't to talk about really a very specific slate of policy proposals. What he was talking about and what ended up being able to organize and mobilize a massive majority to defeat Orban at the polls while they still had elections before that civic airspace was closed off was just to focus on his corruption. It was something, the self-enrichment of the regime and its allies was something that pissed off so many regular people that the people who were voting in the coalition for this opposition to Orban was everyone from the purple-haired liberals on college campuses in Budapest to the sort of MAGA equivalent folks out in the countryside. And it was corruption. It was the self-enrichment. It was, you are being robbed by the elite who is robbing you blind. That's the message that worked. It will be a different question to see how to govern moving forward now that Orban has been defeated. But it's a really important lesson for us here in the United States as we try to figure out how to talk about this, whether in the media or in democratic politics.
Do you think, and I want to dive into your book, we could talk for so long, given totally. The work that you do, but do you think that the corruption message is really landing in this country now that there have been so many reports? We just did a show about this, about how the Trump family is once again enriching themselves, but it's a brand new level, especially when you look at the money they're making off of crypto And a number of Trump supporters are investing in his crypto ventures, and they're losing a lot of money in the process. So do you think that message is landing?
I haven't seen polling on this, but sometimes polling can point us in obscure directions. I will say this, Rose. Authoritarianism is about two things. It's about stealing your rights, and it's about stealing your money. That's it. I think that if we boil it down, both of those things tend to elicit really passionate responses in people when it feels like I no longer have the freedom to speak, to write, to say what I once did, to move about, to express myself, to practice my religion, etc. And also, my hard-earned money is either being stolen from me or other people aren't playing by the rules. And I don't know the numbers on what does and doesn't resonate. What I do know is what's happening. And I do know that what's worked in places like Hungary. One thing that we learn from studying authoritarian movements on five different continents is that there are tactics that work, and this is one of them. We can talk about others. But the other thing that I think Americans need to hear is we end up waiting around for the perfect messenger or the perfect coalition or the perfect message or the perfect political maneuver. That's the wrong approach. We just have to start somewhere. And so if it begins to feel as though talking about democracy and authoritarianism and maybe Trump is going to be a fascist and this language that Democrats have tried isn't breaking through, we have to try different things. And I'm very encouraged by people like Senator Ossoff. Senator Murphy in Connecticut is doing this too. But there are other people who are doing this in different ways. And we will need many, many messengers and different kinds of messages to get this across, because what works for one, as we've seen in the recent primaries, what works in one political environment is not what's going to work in the other. We need to be willing to have a lot of different paths in.
Exactly. And it's so clear that people want to see tangible changes. And they just feel like by electing Democrats year after year, depending on where they live, they're just not seeing things get better. And that is why so many of these Democratic socialists are winning. And it's just going to be fascinating to see how this plays out over the next couple of months going into the midterms. I mean, just to look at last night's race, as you mentioned, I mean, Angie Nixon, she got 56% of the vote.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. I think we need to be paying attention to that. You know, there does seem to be an effort in some quarters to dismiss some of this as a courant or just a product of the moment. But clearly, we all need to be listening to people and to voters. And it's important to follow that voice.
On today's Your Call, we are speaking with Ami Fields Meyer, senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation and a former senior policy advisor at the White House during the Biden administration. Ami Fields Meyer is co-author with journalist Julia Angwin of the new book On Courage, How to Be a Dissident in an Age of Fear. If you have any questions or comments for Ami, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. For this book, Ami and Julia interviewed over 100 dissidents and activists around the globe, and the interviews are incredible. What these people are doing, what they have faced, is just so amazing. And I really hope you can get your hands on this book to read these stories. I was really affected, and I keep thinking about this quote from a former Venezuelan opposition leader who told you, "You are in a new reality and you need to behave like it." I just can't stop thinking about that and what that means to different people.
Yeah. Well, this gets to the way we opened this conversation, which is that part of the strategy of the authoritarian right in this country and in other countries, but if you listen to people like Steve Bannon, is to flood the zone and to disorient us and to move so quickly that by the time we realize what exactly is happening, it's too late. And this is something that we hear over and over again from dissidents all over the world, which is don't wait, as I've just said, don't wait for the perfect opening or opportunity to take action, whether it's in your workplace, in your community, in your home country, whatever it is that's happening that you really should do something. You know, we talk to people, we chose, this book is not a work of political science. We rely on a lot of academics to help us ground our theories and some of what we write about. This is a book of stories. The book is an invitation to the movement. There are 16 different lessons that are in this book that basically take you from the moment that you realize that something is wrong. You know, I'm a lawyer and my office is considering accepting the coercion of being bullied into a deal with the administration. I'm a university professor and my research funding is now at stake. I realize that there are undocumented people in my neighborhood and I need to find a way to step up and do something about it. So we take you in this book from those moments all the way through to building a coalition. But the book is a bit of a buffet menu of options. We recognize that no two people are necessarily going to do the same thing to object. And so we tell a story about a civil servant, a lawyer in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, who realized that this Trump administration was no longer really enforcing civil rights in housing. And so he decided, despite major risks, to speak out. We talk to a different Venezuelan person, a Venezuelan woman in the outskirts of Caracas, who had been part of the authoritarian left, Maduro and Chavez regime, but who realized when she could not feed her children anymore that she needed to begin to organize, not because she was a dissident, not because she was an oppositional figure, but because she was a mom and she needed to find a way to move forward. This is the same kind of work, the same type of inner work that dissidents have got done for many years. Back to the Soviet dissident movement, we write about writers, scientists, academics, who were not able to do their work anymore when Stalin passed a number of repressive laws and really weighed two different kinds of fears against each other, which was the fear that if I do speak out, if I do continue my work, if I do continue to be an activist, if I do seek a more democratic future, then I have the fear that I might lose something like my immediate safety or my status or my wealth. But every dissident in the entire book, everyone that we profile and almost everybody who we spoke to weighed that against a different fear, which is that if I don't speak out, if I don't do something, if I don't act now, I will be judged in the eyes of history or a higher power or my children, or I'll live somewhere outside of my values. And the people who we profile in this book are people who, under various different circumstances of repression and fear, chose to be motivated by those second things and did it anyway.
We have an email from Natalie who linked to a recent show we did about the anti-ICE protesters in Texas who got 30 to 100 years in prison, and what a message that sends to other activists. And Natalie said, can you talk about the message that sends to other activists? And based on the interviews that you did, what is the most effective form of activism at this point?
You know, under the Soviet Union, the apparatus of that it took to keep ordinary citizens in place was much more cumbersome and heavy and costly and resource intensive than what Putin uses now. I know we're asking about the United States, but I'm going to analogize in a way that should make us all very uncomfortable. What later autocrats have realized, later authoritarians have realized, and Putin is sort of the ultimate here, is that you don't actually need a vast surveillance state in the way that they had in the later years of the Soviet Union, or the middle to later years of the Soviet Union. What you can use instead is something that academics call selective repression or selective persecution. And this is when you pick somebody in every sector of society, in every industry, and make an example out of them. So if you look to Russia, where they, you know, every couple years will arrest and try musicians who have done music that seems or is oppositional to the Kremlin. Russia, and the same thing is true of businessmen and political opposition leaders, you know, Russia is known in our, we think of Russia now as a place with lots and lots and lots of political prisoners, but actually it doesn't rank very high, excuse me, in the global rankings of political prisoners per capita, because it doesn't take that many high profile cases to create what one former political prisoner, Andrei Pivovarov, who ran an organization called Open Russia, told us that he calls fear in your kitchen, which is that you don't have to know someone. You just have to have seen this happen a couple of other times before you think twice about this. So that's the premise here. Now, I don't know whether Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon or Trump's other henchmen and mind melders are explicitly studying a Putin. But we do know that they're explicitly studying people like Viktor Orban. And we do know that it's very important to them that they understand this sort of civic psychology. And so that's the goal. The goal is to send the message that if you so much as get in our way, whether you are a member of the political opposition or just an activist, we are going to come for you. It's going to be the power of the state against you with everything we've got. What that means in response, what that means about what's effective, is that we can never, ever, ever give in. That we cannot, that as authoritarianism is about closing off civic airspace, we have to continue to push back. And it's why it's important that especially political leaders never be cowed into submission, and that, and this is really important, this is a sort of a critical piece, that the people who might come to their aid in public do so. That civic players, but also corporate leaders and other political leaders continue speaking up, even if it feels you feel fearful that the president might come for you next. The second that those of us who are watching this decide to stay quiet, the second authoritarianism has crept further and further into the United States.
That was so interesting to learn about the number of political prisoners in Russia, because you're right. I think a lot of people might assume that the jails, the prisons are just full of political prisoners. But as you said, that's just not the case when you look at other countries per capita. And Vladimir Gelman, a political scientist and former Russian democratic activist, talked about this. He said, modern autocrats have no need to rely on massive repression as a means of maintaining their dominance. Fear does most of the work. And you cited a 2025 survey in the book on courage, and it found that when you talk to Russian students, more than 6 in 10 say they're afraid to share their views on campus. So the fear is very, very deep.
Look, one thing that we get asked a lot when we're out on the road talking about this book is, where are the young people? which I think is a funny question. People say, where are all the young people in the democracy movement? This often happens. I say this with love and no denigration, in groups of people. You know, a lot of the people who will come out to quote unquote democracy spaces are of an older generation. And I think there are two answers to that question. One is the thing that we spoke about before, which is that the word democracy, the sort of abstract notion of democracy, means less when you can't really plan for owning a home, when wages are down, when it's hard to find work, when rent is so high. But the other thing is that there were a lot of students out in the streets a couple of years ago over Israel-Palestine issues. Mm-hmm. And the way that universities responded to those student protesters, the way that many private employers responded, people were doxxed at best. Many people lost jobs and job opportunities. Many people were profiled on websites like Canary Mission and other places that profile student protesters. And many, worse, have now been the subject of deportation proceedings. And so I bring this up because this is of a piece with the Russian statistic that you just brought up. You know, when that Venezuelan leader, that Venezuelan opposition leader who you quoted from the beginning of our book, says you need to be aware that you're in a different reality now, he doesn't mean that communism has come to America or that Nazism has come to America. What he means is that the signs of authoritarianism are consistent across the board and that we need to be really clear about them when we see them.
Well, thank you so much for the question. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Virginia in Berkeley. Hi, Virginia. Thanks for holding.
Hi. In the U.S., the U.S. has over 800 bases all over the world. Neither the Soviet Union nor Venezuela nor Russia have anything like that. In the U.S., there's a pyramid of wealth where a very tiny percentage of humans and entities own almost all the wealth, and it's such that cities and states feel that they have to kowtow to this. They won't do fair taxation. Instead, they all pour money into these high-rise, dense condo schemes. They've gotten a lot of young people on board with these because there is no fair taxation. And I wish that what the leaders, the so-called leaders that we vote in these communities would do almost all their time is create dialogue between people in their communities so that each community would push and push and push to get a fair taxation policy in this country. And until we do, I don't see any of this changing in Democratic or Republican. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for the call. Ami, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the book is not about fair taxation or tax policy, but what I will say is that what is very clear is that the conditions for an authoritarian to step in were ripe. It was sort of like, you know, a lot of dry foliage waiting around for a match to strike, because when there is such profound social inequality and wealth disparity, people begin to look for alternatives. And so I agree with the caller in that if many of our institutions had been working better to begin with, if our country had been fairer and more equal to begin with, then the opening would not have been so wide for an authoritarian movement to step in and to bring us to where we are at the moment.
And final thoughts, Ami, I wish we had more time. We would love to have you back because I really want to talk more about the people that you interviewed. But given that, you know, we are, what is it, a year and a half into this administration, after doing these interviews, we have a few more emails about effective activism. A lot of people just don't know what to do. People have been on the streets calling for wars to end, on the streets calling for, you know, taxes to pay for basic services, as Virginia just said. What else would you like to share with people about what is most effective at this point?
Well, I'll say two things, Rose. One is the orientation that Americans need to take on is something that the political scientist Maria Stephan calls collective stubbornness. Authoritarianism comes crashing down when the people begin to throw sand in the gears of the institutions that uphold it. That means that even though we're used to engaging with the tools of democracy, that is elections and litigation and legislation and showing up every couple of years, we need to keep doing those things. But we also need to begin to experiment with and use other tools that many of us are less comfortable with, like strike and boycott and civil resistance, civil disobedience. That's one. But the second thing I'll say is the four basic takeaways from this book, which is that when you begin to realize that you object to what is going on in your community or your country, there are four things to do. The first is that when you hear that voice of objection in your head, instead of suppressing it, follow it. Follow it. This is what we hear from people all over the world. This is not the more natural thing to do because there are risks, but you should follow the voice that says something is wrong and to do the thing and voice the objection. The second thing out of four, and I'll say these quickly, the second thing is that we heard from people all over the world is that the best way to do that, the best way to follow that voice is to find other people who share your values. Americans don't tend to have political homes. We have other forms of community like religious community or social community, civic community is much harder, and we don't generally have a political home. So everybody should find a place to organize regularly, to show up every week or every couple of weeks to be with people who share your values. The third thing is don't do stupid stuff, no unforced errors. People tend to think that being a dissident, that being an objector means taking on unnecessary risk, but that's not what we should do. There are a lot of things, we write about it. The entire third section of our book is about how to stay safe as an activist, especially under digital surveillance. And the fourth thing, and this is really important, is to commit yourself to persuasion, to expanding your political home, to working on non-traditional, strange bedfellows, alliances, and coalitions, to make your alliances bigger, and to find people who you can work with, even though you don't agree on everything, but who agree that at the basic level that we need a multiracial constitutional democracy in this country. And if you can do those four things, then the whole country will be off to a much better place and a much more hopeful place in the future.
Ami Fields-Meyer is co-author of the new book On Courage, How to Be a Dissident in an Age of Fear. Ami is senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Allen Lab for Democracy Renovation and a former senior policy advisor at the White House during the Biden administration. Ami, thank you. Thanks to you and Julia for this book. We would love to have you back. I feel like we just scratched the surface. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'd love to join you again. Thanks for having me, Rose.
Great. Thank you so much. And coming up on Your Call, we are going to find out why San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie has terminated a contract with Hospitality House's 6th Street Center in downtown San Francisco. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.